If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. I hope you're all having a nice Christmas. And on today's podcast, we've got something to mark the festive season. A conversation about some of the most surprising incidents in the history of Christmas, from disturbing greeting cards to obscene snowmen. To find out more about the stranger side of our festive traditions, I spoke to the historians Sam Willis and James Daybell, who are the creators of the Histories of the Unexpected book and podcast series, which takes a sideways look at some of history's most popular topics. I started by asking Sam and James how they went about uncovering the unexpected history of our Yuletide traditions. It's James's voice that you'll hear first.
Well, we're very subversive at Histories of the Unexpected. I think that's it. I think subversion is what we do. So if you think about a standard history of Christmas, it's the Nativity, it's the birth of Christ, the Christmas story, its celebrations, feasting customs, is the Victorian invention of Christmas, all those sort of other things that we associate with it, Christmas trees, crackers, cards, presents, Father Christmas even. But what we wanted to do was to kind of flip it on its head and go, actually, it's not about all of those things. There are different ways of getting into it.
I remember the car journey where we actually brainstormed this.
Yes.
And you went, well, you didn't even think about it. You said, well, Christmas is actually all about animal cruelty.
Yes. What? Animal cruelty, carrots, migration, shoes, electrification, mindfulness, empire, bad luck.
Some pretty dark and sinister topics there that you...
Well, so bad, should we start with bad luck?
Yes.
So bad luck for us. Yeah, we often think of Christmas as a very sort of joyous, sort of celebratory time, but oftentimes people have seen it as a time... full of superstition, fraught with bad luck. Robins, for example, you know, you look at the robin outside and you think of robin as a real sort of symbol of Christmas, and you see it on Christmas cards all the time. But there are certain parts of the country where receiving a Christmas card like that with a robin on it would be seen as bad luck. So, for example, in Gloucester in the 1950s, receiving a Christmas card with a robin on would be seen as greeted with absolute horror, because the idea is that these kind of birds entering the house were a portent of impending death within the family. Likewise with holly, we're all used to having holly inside, but holly is seen as something that is, you know, a harbinger of death. And even in certain parts of the world, you know, once you've had holly in the house, there are certain ways of getting rid of it, you know, so that you have to burn it afterwards to get rid of all those evil spirits. Or even letting fire leave the house on Christmas Day is something else that people aren't allowed to do. This is a 19th century sort of belief. This is way before those sort of Lucifer matches that people would have. And so if, for example, somebody came to your house on Christmas Day, they had no fire, they couldn't cook their turkey, they asked you for a light, you wouldn't be allowed to give them a light from your fire. Because it would be bad. See, it's all about, it's not only about bad luck, it's also about being rude to neighbours.
Being rude to neighbours, being justified. Well, one of the things about it is once you look into, just to say this little aspect of it, where you've got these kind of strange traditions, as far as I'm concerned, then because some of them are so weird, or they're so, as we see them as weird, because we don't necessarily know them, we don't understand the context of what's going on, I think it gives us licence to basically invent any old nonsense and have it as a tradition.
I don't agree with
that. I know you don't agree. But I think, you know, that's weird. Who suddenly decided that taking someone, right? Someone somewhere was sitting in his house, minding his own business, and decided that it was bad luck to take light outside, take a fire outside. There wasn't a kind of a meeting when everyone sat around and said, look, should we decide that it's good luck or bad luck to take fire outside? Some person has had this idea and it's weirdly caught on. So how's that happened? And why are we not allowed to make the... I might just say, well, actually taking light outside, red light on Christmas at 10 minutes to midnight, very lucky.
It would have to catch on, though. So we're talking about...
I know, so
talking
that's a really weird thing to catch on.
Superstitious
that
beliefs
happen?
That are, you know, that are widespread. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
For which I do not have the answer.
I reckon there was a... No, I mean, who does? But I reckon it's really interesting if you stop and think about where traditions, particularly weird ones, came from. And it came from one, I suspect, really creative person having a bit of a laugh.
Earlier on, James, you said that you like to subvert things. And I think a lot of Christmas traditions in the past have been a time for subverting the norm and societal subversion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are all sorts of traditions of that. I think certainly we're quite blessed living down in the West Country. That sort of thing still goes on, you know, as part of folk traditions in various towns and villages around the Southwest. So this idea of the Lord of Misrule, where, you know, you have the custom that people who basically were a sort of lower down in society and would constantly be subordinate to others and taking orders, suddenly on one day a year were allowed to sort of ape that tradition. It was the world turned upside down. They would dress up and go around the town causing havoc. And so that, I mean, traditionally, those kinds of charivari or those sort of sort of popular folk traditions were a way of letting out the sort of pent-up social pressures within society in what is a sort of, you know, humorous, jocular kind of, you know, fun sort of way.
But it's interesting, it came out at Christmas because the world turned upside down, example. It didn't just happen at Christmas. It happened all over Europe. There are examples of it actually, you know, all over the world where people choose to do this and they mess around with authority. They play with social structure. And that's very, very popular because it gives people who don't necessarily have a voice in life a bit of a moment to actually sing and shout. One of the ones I know most about is that they did it crossing the equator on ships. And it's still something that happens now. And the whole rigid, organized structure of a ship gets turned on when they cross the equator. So the point is that is an established tradition. And I think they use Christmas as an excuse to do the tradition that they really, really like.
One of the examples that we came across was in Renaissance Europe, in Brussels, 1510 to 1511, and it was the winter fair. During the cold winter of 1510 to 1511, the citizens of Brussels built around 110 snowmen. And so there was a whole sort of festival of snowmen. The town was just full of these. And what was interesting about these is if you look in detail about what they were so subversive and often very obscene. So there were all sorts of things depicting folklore figures such as unicorns and mermaids, religious and political themes, but also the extremely sexual and even scatological. One of the more sexualized sculptures could be found in the red light district of the city, which depicted a prostitute completely naked with breasts and genitalia sculpted to attract attention and a dog ensconced between her legs. There was also a snow cow that delivered turds, farts and stinking, a defecating senator, a mannequin pee fountain depicting a small boy urinating into the mouth of a drinker, and finally a drunk drowning in his own excrement. So these are quite subversive, far from the jolly, happy soul that we know as Frosty the Snowman from the 1950s song. So really sort of really subversive.
I think it's interesting as well. I mean, I recently went to Harbin in China, in the far, far north of China, where they have the Harbin ice sculpture.
Ooh.
If anyone's near a computer, just Google the Harbin ice sculpture. It's absolutely amazing. And it's all quite structured there, and it's all controlled. And I love the idea of these guys in Brussels saying, it makes me think that someone suggested, well, I'll tell you what, everyone, why don't we all get together and we'll have a really nice snow sculpture party, a snow sculpture event. And then someone just sat there and went, I'll tell you what, mate, I've got a really good idea. We are going to do the rudest ones we possibly can, and we're going to get everyone in the entire city to do it. So yet again, I'd love to know who came up with that idea. But it's, you know, it's part of the subversion.
But this idea of subversion, I think we can also read that into Christmas cards. And we looked at this when we found a sort of collection of Victorian Christmas cards that were actually really spiteful. The Victorian Christmas card was commercially first produced in 1843 by Sir Henry Cole. And once you get the sort of halfpenny stamp from about the 1870s onwards, you find that this kind of democratized post becomes much more commonplace. And there are some scrapbooks that survive in a museum in the Midlands that have a collection of the most weird, sinister-looking Christmas cards you've ever come across, including, here's our friend the Robin, including an image of a dead robin, a child boiled in a teapot, a clown sneaking up on a policeman in order to assault him. It's kind of like a sort of Banksy Victorian Christmas card.
Is that the one with the red hot poker? He's just jabbing him in the bum with a poker.
He looks like he's going to attack him. Yeah. A grisly-looking snowman and a frog walking away with a dagger in his hand, having stabbed another frog in the heart.
And stolen his wallet. The dead robin one's fascinating. It is a dead robin and there's nothing else, right? In the middle of a cream-coloured card, the robin is flat on its back, wings out slightly, little robin-y feet, you know, raised up. And it's motionless, and it is an ex-Robin. And at the bottom of the card, it just says, "May yours be a joyful Christmas." Unlike this poor Robin, I'm assuming, is what it's, you know, is what it's like. So, I mean, the reasoning behind it, so we need to talk to someone who is an expert on the Victorian sense of humour.
Dead robins are quite a good point for me to pick up something you mentioned earlier, which I think a lot of people at home will be saying, "What? Christmas is about animal cruelty." Mm. Explain.
One of my favourite traditions, this is another sort of thing about me, Christmas. I have my Christmas traditions, one of which is that I need to read certain books each year. So I read the Pickwick Papers, the Christmas scenes from that. I read Christmas Carol. I read Wind in the Willows, the sort of Christmas scene there.
Christmas family having a lovely time. James silent in the corner reading Dickens.
No. I'm not there on Christmas Day, like just sort of reading for 8 hours. But in that kind of run up to Christmas. But one of my favourites is Dylan Thomas's Child's Christmas in Wales, which describes a sort of semi-autobiographical account of Dylan Thomas growing up and these various sort of Christmases that he would have spent. And he describes being outside, before he's called in for Christmas lunch, being outside with his friends and basically stalking, like hunters, these cats and then cruelly waiting till he sees the whites of the eyes of the cats and then just hurling snowballs at them.
Here we are. This is part of the poem. So, A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas in the early 1950s. It was always snowing at Christmas. December in my memory is white as Lapland, though there were no reindeers.
but there were cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slink and slide over the white back garden walls and the lynx-eyed hunters. Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson's Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. And it's just actually one aspect. There's a whole history of people being cruel to cats. And being cruel to cats at Christmas is a perfect opportunity because snow provides you with weapons. But also there's... it comes up right to the present day, and there's been a lot of noise in the press as well about how miserable it can be if you're a pet, particularly a new pet, particularly a present at Christmas, and how pets are often ignored, pets not walked. So there's actually a much broader, like real contemporary issues to do with what happens to the pets in our lives at Christmas Day. And it's not necessarily a very nice one.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
This is a letter to Santa penned by two young Dubliners in dated 1911. And it survived inside a fireplace for 81 years. And it's written, "Good luck, Father Christmas. I want a baby doll and a waterproof with a hood and a pair of gloves and an apple and a gold penny and a silver sixpence and a long toffee." Isn't that sweet?
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
On a somewhat jollier note, we can't talk about Christmas without talking about food and drink. You must have some historical oddities to share with us on that.
Carrots.
Yes, definitely. I have carrots. During the Second World War, while rationing was imposed and supply lines were cut across the British Empire, the sort of luxurious treats that you'd expect on your table were greatly diminished. And one of the things that we came across when writing our book on World War II was a recipe for a carrot Christmas pudding called a War and Peace Christmas pudding, which was an alternative to sort of traditional Christmas pudding using carrots instead of mincemeat. And it was first made in Canada during the Great War and then sort of continued. And it consisted of flour, breadcrumbs, suet, grated raw potato, carrot to bulk out the mixed dried fruit and spice. And there was a lack of fortified spirit, so you wouldn't feed this.
You'd feed it with cold and misery.
I was on board until the suet and the potatoes.
Well, that would be to sort of stodge it out and give it weight. But there are early recipes for Tudor mince pies as well, which was basically meat. heavily sort of meat-based. The National Archives used to have a Christmas card that was based on, they had a sort of picture of this 16th century recipe, mince pie recipe. It's also all about empire, because when rationing was not on, if you think about the ingredients that go into a traditional Christmas pudding, they basically come from across the British Empire. So if you think about it, you've got currants from Australia, raisins from South Africa, minced apple from Canada, demerara sugar from the West Indies, ground cloves from Zanzibar, brandy from Cyprus. And during the early 20th century, George V and his family at Sandringham, Christmas 1927, enjoyed an extra special festive pudding produced by their royal chef, who used all of the ingredients from the empire. And this was sponsored by the Colonial Institute, who described it as a symbol of unity of empire. And they desired that every household in the country should eat such a pudding. And part of this was about supporting the trade of empire.
I was thinking about that the other day, actually, because I thought I'd cook something quite Christmassy. And my go-to choice of cooking something Christmassy was to put cloves in it,
which
obviously came from British-controlled areas of Africa.
Yes.
And I'd never really thought about it before, but the way you can read empire and changing empire and changing tastes into the history and into the smell of Christmas, but it's a very distinctive smellscape.
Yes.
Isn't there? That it only really works if you've got certain sort of really, really key things. And yeah, it's fascinating to see how that was influenced and affected by trade routes.
Yes.
In the feature you wrote for our Christmas issue of BBC History Magazine, you talk about some of the figures other than Father Christmas, of course, that other cultures have imagined up around Christmas.
This is all connected to the chimney, isn't it?
It absolutely is. So rather than thinking about who specifically has been invented, you just need to know that there are. It's not all happy Father Christmassy stuff. There are other ghouls and goblins. And that's all linked to chimneys, particularly because chimneys are an unprotected way into the house. Chimneys are dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are all, if you look at throughout sort of European folklore, there are all chimneys have always been associated with the supernatural as an entry point into the household, you know, whether this be evil or whether it be good. So if we have a look in Greece and Serbia, the Kalakantsaroi are Christmas goblins who are believed to live underground for most of the year, and they surface during the 12 days of Christmas to come down your chimney into the house and basically to wreak havoc. And one of the ways of preventing them, these evil beings descending down your chimney, is to light a Yule log in it during the 12 days of Christmas, or to throw a pair of foul-smelling shoes onto the flames, which would ward off these evil spirits. And what we see is that these kind of traditions they migrate across the Atlantic to North America. So there are early depictions of St. Nicholas, and they associate him with dropping gold coins down chimneys. So, for example, in 16th century Holland, which led to the tradition of children placing shoes on the hearth on the feast of St. Nicholas. And they'd awaken in the morning to see their shoes full of, rather than stockings, full of sweets and coins. And Italian folklore, an old woman named Befana, sometimes known as the Christmas witch, delivered gifts to children on the eve of Epiphany, the 6th of January, slipping them into shoes by the fireplace. And then these traditions go across to America and spread and are connected to St. Nicholas coming down the chimney. And we've written a chapter on chimneys in our first book, Histories of the Unexpected, How Everything Has a History, that describes how this is connected to certain key publications, Knickerbocker's History of Christmas, and I think Clement Seymour's Twas the Night Before Christmas, which are some of the first depictions of Father Christmas.
If you could offer an unexpected historical fact for people to share over their turkey dinners with their families, what would it be?
One of the most interesting archives of historical things we've come across are children's letters to Father Christmas, which have been found up chimneys. So go and check what's inside your chimneys. Chimneys are actually archives full of all sorts of the most amazing historical material. So you might think that a child writes down their wish list, sets fire to it, and it disappears up the chimney. When actually what happens more often than not is that it half burns and gets stuck there, where it stays for sometimes decades until some builders come along, renovate the house, and they find kids' letters to Father Christmas up the chimney. Brilliant.
This is a letter to Santa penned by two young Dubliners dated 1911, and it survived inside a fireplace for 81 years. And it's written, "Good luck, Father Christmas. I want a baby doll and a waterproof with a hood and a pair of gloves and an apple and a gold penny and a silver sixpence and a long toffee." Isn't that sweet? And there are dozens of these that we've come across in various archives. But a fact that I would share with you is that Christmas is as much about violence and rioting, back to our subversion, as much about violence and rioting as it is with sharing and caring. And it's well known that Oliver Cromwell and his Puritans sought to abolish Christmas, which they saw as a popish superstition. They passed an ordinance by Parliament in June 1647, which threatened punishment to anyone who celebrated this festival. Now, as you can imagine, the ban didn't go down very well in all quarters. And in December 1647, many of the citizens of Canterbury defied it, taking to the streets to riot. And this is described in a pamphlet called Canterbury's Christmas, or A True Relation of the Insurrection in Canterbury on Christmas Last. And it describes how shops that stayed open on this holy day were ransacked, the mayor, aldermen and constables attacked, and the sheriff knocked down. His head fearfully broke. It was God's mercies his brains were not beat out. So there we are.
And there are other examples of that as well. People getting stressed, people getting drunk. That happens quite a lot on Christmas Day. And if your family ends up having a bit of a row by the end of the day, just have the reassurance that you're not alone and it's been happening for years and years and years.
Happy Christmas, everyone. Yeah.
That was Sam Willis and James Daybell. Sam and James wrote a feature about unexpected festive history for the Christmas issue of BBC History magazine, on sale now. They've also recently released four new books in the Histories of the Unexpected series on some of the blockbuster topics of history: the Tudors, Vikings, Romans, and the Second World War. All four of those books are on sale now, published by Atlantic. Sam and James are also about to head out on tour. You can catch their Histories of the Unexpected live shows at various locations across the UK throughout 2020. Head to historiesoftheunexpected.com to find out more. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us again on the 30th of December when Catherine Harvey will be telling me why medieval people were not as filthy as you might think.